Well, you may have heard about this at Memphis this week. Those Tigers, man, they do some crazy things. But I just want to read part of this story to you to get started tonight. And you can see we're talking about taming the tongue, talking about words and the power of words and our speech. But listen to this story. Bright yellow signs serve as a warning for the faint of heart and sensitive at the University of Memphis this week. Words on student plaza may be viewed as offensive, one of the signs says. Rated mature, says another poster. And the warning is, according to those who have seen the words, an understatement. Smack dab in the middle of campus is a project put together by the Student Activities Council called The Writing on the Wall. 420 bricks, each hand-painted by U of M students, contain words like bimbo, nerd, crybaby, redneck, harsher terms, one I won't repeat, slut, whore, are included along with the N-word. The one that hurts freshman Munir Muhammad the most, terrorist and jihadist, he says, because I'm a Muslim myself and those have been used against me. The hate wall, as some have come to call it, was unveiled Monday, March 30th to help dispel stereotypes and build relationships. I think that's true, but I didn't get that impression immediately. Some haven't been for it because they think we don't need to put these words on open display. Clearly, they're bad words. All right? Don't think we even need to put these kind of words on display. One freshman said, "This is a good reminder that words matter." Okay? You see that some words are used so loosely. And when you see it up on the wall, it means someone doesn't like you saying that word. It's something that is hurtful. And this Friday, April 3rd, the wall will come crashing down, a symbolic tearing down of the walls and words that divide us. So I initially thought, well, this is a terrible experiment, and probably still is in some ways. But I guess they're just trying to, in some ways, be honest about the words we use, and they are going to destroy the wall and try and symbolically represent this is not what we want to say. But they're kind of giving language to it and then saying, this is not what we want to say. So, the hate wall in Memphis. Probably don't want Rebels for Christ doing that anytime soon. Maybe if they do it on campus, we'll figure out our response. But I did want you to think about that because I really appreciated some of the things they said about how words matter and words are important and we use words loosely, carelessly sometimes. And so I kind of want you to think a little bit further about times when you have used words to hurt people and people have used words to hurt you. I still remember Tracy would be great at telling a couple of times when she still remembers from elementary school comments today that were made to her back then that really negatively impacted her self-image because of the comments that were made to her back then. You know this. You probably have those same experiences where some memories just stick with you because the words hurt so much. Of course, we are not guilt-free. We have no doubt thrown our own verbal barbs at folks as well. And it can be obviously just making fun of someone, to insulting or threatening someone, to the extreme of verbal abuse. And so, I really want you to be thinking about words tonight. You know, we have these pithy sayings like, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Well, that's wrong, as far as I can tell. I mean, maybe there's some times when we're strong enough to withstand certain harsh words, depending on how we are in life at the time. But, you know, we have another proverb, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. So we try and talk about these kind of things. But you can, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but this just tries to bear witness to this idea of how dangerous our tongue is, okay, how powerful our words are. These words in James always haunt me, but let's read these real quick. The tongue is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. I like how James sugarcoats things. He always, tries to make you feel good about your tongue. But yeah, the tongue, James just really comes out and tells us, man, this thing is messed up. It is the source. You know, we talk about foot and mouth disease. We stick our foot in our mouth. I mean, so often, right, we are guilty of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person on the wrong day. And so there's just so many implications in how we use our words. And I wanted to remind you, we've talked about this a little bit, but Peter is really interested in words and speech and the tongue in 2 Peter. And you can see some of those verses up there. Rid yourselves of slander. He's talking to the church. Outsiders and be there, though they accuse you of doing wrong. There's accusations from outside Christianity that are accusing Christians. See is silence ignorant talk of foolish men. D is no deceit was found in his mouth, talking about Jesus. E, when he suffered, Jesus, he made no threats. And even in this very practical section, chapter 3, that we're not really dealing with, husbands may be won over without words by the good behavior of their wives. So Peter's really on the, you don't really need to say a whole lot. You need to live a godly life. And that'll shut people up that are accusing you. That might even shame them in a good way to hush them up. And it might even be for their conversion, ultimately. So Peter's really concerned about words here. So when we get to chapter 3, verse 8, where we're spending a little bit of time in that and following tonight, he's talking to the church. He's been talking to the church about submitting to these authorities, slaves submitting to masters, wives and husbands, and their relationship of submission. He says in verse 8, finally, all of you live in harmony with one another. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. So obviously a good question right now, you know, in your relationships with students in this ministry, with other Christians among us, in your home church perhaps, can you say tonight, I'm living in harmony with my brothers and sisters in Christ. I am sympathetic to their pain, to their struggles. I care about what's going on in their lives and not just my own. Do I love these people as my brothers and sisters in Christ? Am I compassionate? Do I have a soft heart to anything that's going on in somebody else's life? Am I humble instead of prideful about these things? And I think it's neat how Peter sets this out, because I think what he's trying to say is that this is the kind of community that is envisioned where people can tame their tongues, where they can know when to speak and when not to speak. They're going to be sympathetic. And somebody's lost their job and they've been out of a job for a few months. Why don't you just get a job? You know? Oh, we probably don't do that. We put our arm around that person, we pray for them, and we say, man, this really stinks that you've been out of work this long. And I know you're working hard. Is there anything I can do to help you find a job as well? There's just this much different atmosphere that's created in God's people where the tongue is tamed, where we know what to say and when to say it, where people don't regret what they say out of anger, where words are few but encouraging, powerful, and gracious. And so you see, in contrast to this, in verse 9, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. Now, the easy examples, I thought of repaying evil for evil is what continues to go on in Northern Ireland, is what continues to go on with Israelis and Palestinians. In other places in the world, you know about this. There is not such a thing as forgiveness. There is just evil being repaid by evil. Insult with insult would be a bad marriage where, you know, there is no way, there's no parameters for saying, you know, we probably shouldn't talk like this. It's just insult and insult, 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 and then it just, you know, it's just terrible for the relationship, and there's really no way by the end of all that, at the end of the night or the end of the week or whenever you finally hush, you know, it's terribly hard to forgive when you've both been insulting each other so much, so that there's so much pain. And so Peter sees that we cannot be the type of people who repay with evil, who repay with insults. We repay with this radical idea of blessing. And of course, you know this feeling where someone puts you down or cuts you off or does something to stir your emotions, and the tongue is ready to be released. And you feel it just naturally. It's just so natural. It's like you look back later and you go, man, I didn't even have time to stop that. I didn't even have time to think about what I was just saying. And so you think about this, and you know, part of me wants to ask Peter, don't you realize how hard it is to do this kind of thing in the face of these persecutions? You know, Peter's struggle here is a church that's being verbally persecuted by those around them. And, you know, you might, you know, I'd need to create a conversation for this kind of thing where an outsider, you know, speaks to a Christian. And for the Christian, you know, like two ways you could handle it. A Christian who handles it well and a Christian who just, you know, starts fighting back and insulting back. And just it escalates and it gets out of control. And it's just a terrible sight for Christians and the non-Christians. Because we end up playing by their rules, right? We end up acting just like the world. But now Peter pulls in this psalm in verse 10, where it says, "Whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech." Now I assume most of us want to love life and see good days. And as a general rule, when you hold your tongue, when you tame it, when you let God tame it, you see good days. You love life. And there's actually this power, this strength you find in holding your tongue and not just saying the first thing that comes to your mind a lot of times. And so you think about, you know, we kind of talked about this with slaves and masters, right? Where we talked about the slave's options and how the slave could run away or fight his master back. You know, there's really the best option for the slave for survival, for enjoying his life as much as possible, and even for the conversion of the master, is to submit. And this is one of those instances where it's the same. I mean, we could pick all these other options, but at the end of the day, the best thing to do is repay evil with blessing. To repay insults with blessing. And of course, we want to look at how on earth are we going to do that? What power is going to help us do that kind of thing? So he goes on back after the psalm talking about who's going to harm you for doing good if you're eager to do good. And even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Now this is a phrase Peter's already used some. The general rule, of course, is if you're eager to do good, most of the time people are going to leave you alone. As a general rule, if you're just minding your own business, you know, in our environment, if you're just going to class and doing your work and you're not going crazy on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, whatever, however many nights we party in Oxford these days, if you do free hugs or you pick up trash or you know, whatever kinds of things we could come up with, in general, people are going to leave you alone, and for the most part, they might appreciate your work and your behavior. But sometimes you are going to suffer for doing these kind of things. And Peter again says, what a great way to suffer. If you're going to have to suffer, it's going to be for something good, and that's great. That if you're going to suffer, at least it's not for something stupid you did, not for some really bad sin where you messed up and caused a lot of damage. You're following Christ, and you're suffering for it. That's okay. It actually validates the idea that you're following Christ. And then we're getting really close to the crux here. He says, do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. And that's the NIV. And if some of you look, there's a footnote that says it could be translated, do not fear their threats. Okay? And I think in the context, I really appreciate that better because we're talking about all this verbal persecution. So do not fear their threats. Just a show of hands, has anybody in here been threatened verbally for any reason? Okay. Thank you. Has anybody been threatened verbally because they are a Christian? Was it connected to your faith in any way?
A little bit.
Yeah. Okay. You know, Lenny and I, we kind of hash this out at times. We feel like those stories are out there. We just don't hear them very much in the good old U.S. of A. But that there is, when Christians really are trying to live the Christian life, there is some verbal persecution going on. And we need to share that with one another and let each other know what's going on. But here Peter says, do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened. So already Peter is asking us to repay evil with blessing, to repay insults with blessing, a tall order. And now he's saying, don't fear their threats. Their threats to take your home, to take your livelihood, to take whatever they can from you. If people are in power that aren't Christians and they want to do you wrong, they're going to find ways to do you wrong. You know, I thought a little bit, I didn't get a particular example, but I just thought about, you know, African Americans in the South, civil rights, KKK, all this kind of stuff. No doubt there were these warnings and threats made to African Americans who were threatening the society that the whites apparently really wanted to keep as is. And I just, you know, I wonder about the threats that were made and the fear that was associated with those threats, because, you know, there's two groups, the people that follow through with their threats and the people that don't, and some do. And, you know, deciding how seriously are we going to take these threats when people threaten us is no light matter. But then we get to 15, and here's the crux of everything. You know, really, I think this is almost the core of 1 Peter for us. And you know most of these verses probably pretty well. 1 Peter 3:15, but in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. All right. So I want to pick these words apart real quick here. Set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts. Does anybody have some language to try and describe what you think that means? What does that look like? What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? What goes into letting Christ reside in your heart in such a special way like this? To be set apart, I assume talking about like sanctified, like holiness. We're talking about giving Christ the special place in our heart. Anybody have some language for this really powerful phrase? Very good. Submitting to Christ, very much in the context of submission. So certainly, setting Christ apart as Lord in your hearts means that, yeah, submission. Very good. What else? Okay. Right. Yeah, and so here's where we get the reason for submission. We have a Lord. We have a Master. And He's not just Lord of Christians. He's Lord over the earth. He is Lord of all lords. And that Lord is supposed to be, and rightly so, if He's been raised from the dead, Lord in our hearts. That's a good connection. Submission to Lord. What other language? Good. Let Jesus out of the basement, stop locking him in the basement, and let him have the run of the house, where he gets to decide all decisions. Yeah. When you wake up, when you go to bed, what you eat, what you wear. A little metaphorical here, maybe not literal, but yeah. That's right on. Good example. Anything else coming to you? What this looks like to set apart Christ as Lord.
Set apart. It's treated differently.
Right. Yeah. So even with Tracy's thing, we may have these little lords in our life that constantly compete for the big Lord. But if we're going to let the big Lord reign in the heart, it's going to have everything to say about all this other stuff in our lives when we set it apart. It's good. Well, so one of the connections I want to make here in light of the fact that we're talking about taming the tongue is if we set apart Christ as Lord in our hearts, if he's in the heart, he's going to be able to take care of the tongue. If we try and just focus on the mouth and techniques and, you know, meditation that's disconnected from Christ, if we focus on the heart, out of the overflow of that heart, we're going to end up having a lot better time with taming the tongue. If Christ is in your heart, there's no place for hate. That's right. I used to have a preacher you say, Jesus, get in your heart, and he's just going to rearrange the furniture. That's another phrase kind of with this home idea. You're going to let Jesus get in there, and he is just going to be moving everything around. You're not going to like it for a while. But he's going to root out things like hate if you let him in your heart. Very good. So if you set apart Christ as Lord in your heart, you're going to begin, it's going to become easier to repay evil with blessing. It's going to be easier to not fear their threats. And in light of that, you're going to be able to be prepared to answer your critics and your inquisitors when people want to question you for your beliefs, your actions, you know, whatever it is about your life. If Christ, and it's, you know, it's almost something where you need a little bit of quiet time in the morning where you just remind yourself that today is going to be a day where my heart is set aside for Christ. And out of that, you are more prepared to answer those people that are going to come into your life today critiquing you and questioning you and accusing you, that type of thing. And when you're prepared, this reason you're going to give them for your hope, this reason you have is always going to have something to do with hope. This living hope that we have in chapter 1, because Jesus is still living, is going to infuse your speech. You're going to be able to come up with some amazing things that will probably surprise you later because God was at work in your heart when you start sharing answers that have hope in them. And then here's where Peter gets to taming the tongue. He says, you know, you could give an answer, I guess, with hope, but you could still be kind of nasty about it, you know? And so he says, you still want to do that with gentleness and respect. Because sometimes we can have the truth or we can know the right answer perhaps, but you know, we kind of elevate ourselves, become the know-it-all, finger point down. You know, we can really create a disposition where they don't want to hear it even if we got the right answer. Even if we're talking about hope, they don't want to hear it. So we do it with gentleness and respect. Keeping a clear conscience might... loose paraphrase is, meaning you can sleep at night. That at the end of the day, with what you said to whoever asked you for a reason, you can go to sleep at night thinking, I didn't insult him. I didn't repay evil with evil. I gave God an opportunity to use my words for good. And then those who speak against you maliciously, meaning an intent to harm you. At some point, they may very well be ashamed because you didn't play their game, and they finally realize, man, I didn't get the reaction I wanted. And they end up feeling, I think, good shame, good guilt, good something, because they realize, you know, Christ and that person, you know, beat me. You know, he wasn't willing to play the game like I wanted to play it. So real quick, because I have a really good application that I want us to practice on, let me just run through a few other quick things with you. Just thinking about reflection, that's what I call the look. Just thinking about some of the implications of this, I want you to think about, how did Jesus choose not to hurt people with his words on the cross? All right? You think of the things Jesus said on the cross, all right? I am thirsty. It is finished. Father, forgive them. My God, why have you forsaken me? Today you will be with me in paradise. The only one he talks kind of rough to is God. There's something to be said there. That God, I think, can handle our tough words, our harsh words. And that's another good discussion. See Lindy and Job for that, if you really want to go there. But can anybody... we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Jesus healing us from our wounds in the end of chapter 2 there, I believe. Why was it easier for Jesus to not repay evil with evil? I mean, we say, well, he was, you know, the Son of God. Well, you know, then I'm going to say, well, he was human. what was in him and what was not in him that made it to where he could look at these people that had just nailed him to a cross and say, Father, forgive them? Love. Hesed, agape, find your favorite Hebrew or Greek word for love, and spend a lot of time. That even after all that evil that had been done to him, he still had a heart full of love for these people. And maybe you've seen glimpses of that when you have been hurt for some reason. And there's part of you that wants to fight back, and there's part of you that maybe for a second realizes there's some pain in the other person's life, and you realize they're not who they should be, and they're not acting the way you know they would act if all these other things weren't going on in their lives. Anybody else? How did he choose not to hurt people when he's hanging on the cross there with his words? I mean, that's all he could do at this point if he's going to let this go through. He could have still, man, if anybody could have judged, if anybody could have condemned, it was Jesus, and he could have done it on the cross. Sorry?
He knew why.
Thank you. Yeah, Bob.
The challenge that he gives to me is that he never saw people as they are. He saw them in terms of what they could become. If he had spoken ill, would that Roman soldier standing there say, surely, if he had spoken like every other criminal, the Roman soldier would have been right.
Yeah.
I always wonder about those people at the cross that hurt him, including that Roman soldier, including those that spiked him to the wood. Did they ever find room in their heart for Jesus?
Yeah. We tend to think that power is only shown by exercising verbal or physical force, when Jesus shows the greatest amount of power by restraint. And we for some reason don't tend to put restraint in the category of power, but that is where power resides, when we restrain. I'm going to have to fly here, sorry. Wanted to also get you thinking, why is it so easy for us to use words to hurt people? And when contrast ourselves with Jesus having this great power of restraint, knowing what God had intended for His creation and what they could be still, and yet us continuing to stumble through our words, why is it so much easier for us to fall into the James trap and let the tongue just be this restless evil? This is one that I thought of because I've been guilty of this. But how do we balance sarcasm with real encouragement? You know, this is something that guys do. I had one of my roommates, we used to affectionately call each other idiot. And it was a great thing to do, and it was just lots of fun. But there were times when that got old. And it was like, you know, I kind of would appreciate it if he, you know, say some encouraging, you know, real encouraging things every now and then. And I probably should be saying some real encouraging things every now and then. So I want you to be thinking about your words. And let's, you know, some sarcasm, some biting humor is always, seems like it's part of the male relationship for sure. That's how we show our love sometimes. But I would encourage you guys and maybe gals if necessary, look for ways to offer real encouragement as well. And Peter talked a lot about baptism, and we're not going to be able to get into it a ton right here, but I did want you to think that baptism is this first place where we set apart Christ as Lord. And so in baptism, we begin the process of taming the tongue. That's a connection that we made there. Now, real quick, just a few minutes here while I stumble over everything. I'd really like a few helpers. I know we don't normally do this, but don't make me call on you. I really want to take free hugs, and we did some trash pickup this past Saturday. I just want to pick on a couple of things, and we could pick on other things. I remember we were picking up trash Saturday, and we got several honks. We got a lady that said stopped long enough to say thank you to some of us that were picking up trash. Of course, we always have a great experience doing free hugs. It's a great experiment in every you know, human facial expression from, you know, to, you know, right on to, you know, homosexual, you know, blasphemies to, you know, just outright, this is the thing I needed today more than anything was this hug. So you just get such a wide range. So what I'd really like, because we hope to still maybe do free hugs again before the semester's up on campus. And I can't remember who did this sign. Did anybody want to claim it? I can't remember who might have done this one. This is when we did free hugs and coffee. But I want you to think about, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. And you're holding this sign up on campus. And go ahead and tell me real quick, what are some of the things we have said? When we've been holding the sign and people ask, why are you doing this? Or what's this about? You know, what have we said so far? What have you said? What have other people said? Spreading the love. Yeah. What else? Somebody has said that?
I thought you said how we respond to something that they
ask. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, what are our words of response to them when they ask? You're saying, show Jesus love. Okay.
I know when we did it in Chapel Hill, somebody asked me that, why are you doing it? And I guess like my initial response was because God finds value in each person, and he supports you in each person.
Great. Good.
Why don't you just say hug? And I said,
Right. Answer a question with a question.
Who should have blessed all the peacemakers?
Right.
Said, you know, peace. Well, if you will, peace.
Yeah. So much hate, so we're gonna show love through hugs. Okay, and you know, we've done that enough that I think you've had to think about, you know, what do I want to say, because people have asked. And I just want to continue to push you to think of what am I going to say that is connected to hope. Because what I want each person, when they ask, to hear is something that connects this to something about God, Christ. If we don't make that connection, then we're not really showing them anything that's connected to this living hope that we have. And y'all are sharing some great things here. And of course, you know, you have just, you know, 30 seconds, but that's all it takes to be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. So continue to think about this, particularly when we get ready to do it here again in April. What words could you use? And I think any way in which you can get the words God and love and Christ and several of the things y'all said there are just very helpful. And it might lead to longer discussions if you get to the point. If you leave it vague and you really don't connect them to the hope that you have for doing it, then it can quickly detach itself from our faith. So now here's one to push you on a little bit more. You know, we tried to do this a little bit Saturday. Picking up trash in Oxford. What are some things you could say that would reveal your faith in something as silly or strange or outlandish as just picking up some trash along the highway? How would you connect your hope to that? Rachel, why don't you get in here?
Okay.
Not that you're trash, but just that you would fit. What could we say? This is some of that sarcasm. I'll give you some real encouragement later, okay?
Okay.
See me afterwards.
We've been doing it since the garden.
We've been doing it since the garden. Okay. Creation is a gift. We're going to be stewards of it. We want to keep taking care of it because it's God's. Yeah, what else? Anything come to your mind?
I believe God is coming back one day, and He's going to redeem His planet, make it a new earth. And because I believe that, He's encouraging you to get ahead from it. That's pretty much the question.
Very good. Awesome.
I came to mind and gave you a book.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Yeah, I'm
sorry about that.
No, I'm right there. I'm reading it too. Anything else? What would you say to someone while you're bending over to pick up a 40-ounce beer bottle and you're stuffing it in the sack? What are you going to say? Why are you doing this? Those are good reasons. Very good. The thing I came up with similar to that was we're with Rebels for Christ and we care about Oxford. And I think any of these are great discussion starters. We care about the community we live in. You really have great opportunities to connect your hope to people's questions. So I do want to stop there so we can sing a little bit, but I just want to close with that story at the beginning. On April 3rd, the wall of hate will come crashing down, a symbolic tearing down of the walls and words that divide us. This is the wall that was built on the Memphis campus for this week. 2,000 years ago, the wall of hate thunderously crashed to the ground. A tree of hate and a tree of love held the same God-man while he died. And in his death, he showed us how to speak.